refugees may indeed have this great suffering required for it to be a crime against humanity, but a lot of them clearly don't. And that's, from my understanding, is not the nuance that the report introduced to suggest that all 6 million Palestinian refugees get to go back to Israel, that, you know, that they're all suffering so severely that this is a crime against humanity if they don't. Or separately, you know, could the crime against humanity be satisfied by going to Palestine, you know, the West Bank or Gaza, rather than Israel? I mean, I don't know. But these are the kinds of complexities that need to be addressed rather than just rush through a 33-page report, which just is not long enough, is not detailed enough, doesn't have enough research to get into these complexities to make a compelling case. That's why I never would have allowed this report to get through the review process.
We just have 20 seconds, Omar Shakir from Amman, your final comment.
Look, I think it says something very clear that two former Human Rights Watch staffers are having a discussion about the integrity of the work and the future of the organization. Where is Philippe Loupillon?
Omar Shakir, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Omar has just resigned as Israel-Palestine director at Human Rights Watch after HRW blocked a report which called Israel's denial of the right of return for Palestinians a crime against humanity. And Kenneth Roth, former executive director of Human Rights Watch. That does it for our show. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary at Riverside Church with Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, Maria Ressa, Michael Stipe, Wynton Marsalis, and many others. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We hope to see you there. Go to democracynow.org for information.
Hey, everybody. It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Jay Hawken Productions, presenting a screening of Sumud, a doctor's report on genocide and survival in Gaza, at Cinema 21 on Sunday, February 8th. The screening will be followed by a panel discussion. Tickets and info at cinema21.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new estimate shows the Portland Housing Bureau sitting on a $106 million unspent fund.
Portlanders push to save the Lloyd Center Mall from demolition.
And Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter is barred from visiting a Gresham family held in a Texas detention center.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 6th, 2026. I'm Masato.
And I'm Sam Bowman. The Portland Housing Bureau is sitting on $106 million in unspent funds. That's according to a memo from City Administrator Raymond Lee sent to City Council this afternoon. Some of those dollars may be committed to particular projects, but it's money City Council didn't know about. On Wednesday, Portland City Council passed a resolution to investigate how they weren't informed of the first uncommitted lump sum of $21 million. The former Housing Bureau director found those funds in August, but wasn't allowed to talk about it per a memo she sent to council. Shortly after that, she was asked to resign without cause. In December, City Councilor Mitch Green proposed a hearing about the funds. Last week, the city found another $15 million in unspent funds in the Housing Bureau, which could be spent on affordable housing and rental support. Council President Jamie Dunphy said, quote, "While the timing of this information is difficult, I do not believe these were hidden maliciously, but are instead a relic of the old government system of accounting," end quote. Now, the new City Council resolution asks the Portland City Administrator to uncover public records pertaining to the funds. The resolution passed with an 8-4 vote. It also calls for an oversight hearing to discuss how and why this large financial oversight occurred. Coin News reports that city leaders noted that Portland's old commission-style government may have played a part in the unspent funds. In all, those unspent housing funds now total $106 million. City Administrator Lee recommends more oversight and monitoring of bureau budgets, but writes that it's likely a unique housing bureau issue. Lee wrote to council saying, quote, "We will still move forward with a process to evaluate other city funds to ensure this under-budgeting issue doesn't exist."
Portlanders still like the Lloyd Center Mall, and some don't want to see it demolished. On Thursday, community members flocked to a public hearing on the plan to redevelop the Lloyd Center. The master plan submitted to the city by Owners Urban Renaissance Group and the KKR Real Estate plans for park space, walking paths, and blocks of housing and businesses. Notably absent in the master plan is a year-round ice skating rink, which has existed in some form at Lloyd Center since the mall opened in 1960. City staffers recommend that the Design Commission approve the proposed design. Thursday's hearing is one of two before the Design Commission votes on whether the plan can move forward. Malls across the country have been losing shoppers to online sites like Amazon. Anchor stores were already leaving the Lloyd Center when COVID-19 hit in 2020. The pandemic kept the few remaining shoppers home and forced the closure of the remaining department stores. More recently, the Lloyd Center has turned into a hub for small, independent, and local retailers. The ice skating rink itself still draws a host of people of all ages on a daily basis, demonstrating interest in keeping year-round access to skating. Some 50 people signed up to give testimony during the virtual public hearing. Most opposed the demolition. They say the Lloyd Center that still acts as a gathering space, increasing community connections and providing a place for indoor recreation. The Design Commission is still accepting public comments on the master plan, at least through February 13th. Developers and owners will have an opportunity to respond to concerns before the commission votes on whether the plan can move forward. Urban Renaissance Group has said the current iteration of the mall will close by the end of the year.
One of Oregon's U.S. Congresswomen, Maxine Dexter, was denied entry into the Dilley Immigration Processing Center in Texas. A local Gresham family is detained there, including a 7-year-old girl named Diana. Immigration agents arrested the Crespo Gonzalez family on January 16th while they sought medical treatment for Diana in Portland. Diana had a nosebleed that would not stop. Since arriving to the Texas detention facility, OPB reports that Diana developed a fever and is eating only mayonnaise and bread. Congresswoman Dexter traveled to Texas to achieve the release of the Crespo Gonzalez family. Dexter told OPB, quote, "We have tickets that we've purchased for this family to come home with us Friday night, and I have every intention of bringing them home with me. There's no legal reason for them to be in custody, and they're my constituents, and I'd like to take them home," end quote. Dexter followed protocol and gave notice that she would visit the Texas ICE facility 7 days prior to arrival, but was denied her right to oversight of the facility. Children cannot be held in ICE detention for more than 20 days. Today marks the 21st day the Crespo Gonzalez family is in detention. OPB reports that the family has a pending asylum application, and their asylum court date is set for 2028. Dexter argued that there is zero reason for the family to be held in detention. A Los Angeles-based nonprofit social justice group, Each Step Home, started a campaign calling for Diana's release. The organization also hopes to spread awareness about other children held in immigration detention. Among other issues, two detainees at the Dilley Detention Center are known to have contracted measles.
Health policy experts warn the Medicaid data sharing agreement between federal health officials and immigration enforcement is intensifying fear among mixed-status families. They say it's discouraging parents from seeking medical care for themselves and their U.S.-born children. Oregon and other states joined a lawsuit to limit the practice. But advocates say uncertainty over what information is shared could cause a sharp drop in children's health coverage and harm public health nationwide. Judith Ruiz Branch has more in Illinois.
Health policy experts are voicing concerns about states sharing health information with federal immigration authorities. Illinois officials are doing what they can to prevent or at least limit that sharing. Health systems have long assured patients that their personal information, including immigration status, would not be given to immigration enforcement officials if they apply for safety net programs like Medicaid. That changed last year when immigration enforcement agencies entered into an agreement with federal health officials. Joan Alker with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families says undocumented parents were already fearful of their data being shared. Now they will certainly be too scared to bring their U.S.-born children to see a doctor.
Mixed status families are not going to want to be sharing any information with the government. These, in most cases, are citizen children who are eligible for Medicaid or CHIP. And that's what is known as the chilling effect.
Illinois was one of 22 states that sued to block the data sharing agreement. A judge has since limited what the government can share about Medicaid enrollees in Illinois. But health policy officials say it's not clear exactly what information is being shared or how immigration officials are distinguishing undocumented people from U.S. citizens. One in four American children lives in a mixed-status family. Alker says they estimate the number of children with health insurance could drop by as much as 25% in the coming months.
If we see the numbers rise when we get the data this fall and certainly next fall, we believe that the extraordinary campaign by the Trump administration to intimidate, deport, harass, and terrify immigrant families will be a main cause for that.
It's unclear if health officials are even warning people that their personal information might be shared. Leo Cuello, also with the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown, stresses how much the health and well-being of children and families is now at stake, including U.S. citizens.
If you have an immigrant who is here lawfully or undocumented, who is afraid to go to the emergency room because their data is going to be shared when they are pregnant, that means the birth of a U.S. citizen might not happen in the safest way possible. Setting aside whether it's legal or not, it's just bad health policy.
For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Scenes of shuttered businesses are among the many visible signs of the federal government's immigration crackdown in Minnesota. Civic leaders are asking local residents of these areas to seek out donation opportunities designed to help immigrant-owned businesses that are struggling to stay open. Mike Moen reports.
No matter when the federal government pulls all extra immigration officers out of Minnesota, local leaders say it's clear many small businesses face a long recovery if they can survive. They're asking the public to show extra support for affected shops and restaurants. The Trump administration's Operation Metro Surge doesn't only face criticism for the arrest tactics of ICE and CBP agents. Community voices say people from targeted households are afraid to go to work, forcing immigrant-owned small businesses in culturally diverse neighborhoods to scale back operations or, in some cases, shut down for the time being. B. Kyle leads the St. Paul Area Chamber, and she says it can't just be viewed as a dollars and cents issue.
And let's not forget that these are people whose lives are being disrupted as well as their livelihoods.
GoFundMe campaigns are widely circulating to help those affected by the crisis. There's also the website welovetc.com, which has a donation directory to support restaurants and other small businesses in Minnesota. This week, the White House announced 700 federal officers were leaving the state, but community organizers say that still leaves roughly 2,000 agents, prolonging the negative impacts they've often described. Kyle says if you plan to directly support a business that's struggling because of the situation, there's a specific way to see they get the benefits without creating extra hurdles for the limited staff.
So many immigrant-owned businesses, for example, don't even have the staff to do the work. You could buy a dining card from that business and just hold on to it for future use, or for that matter, just never use it.
Late last month, the regional think tank North Star Policy Action said while it's difficult to produce a firm estimate, its findings suggest a weekly reduction of nearly $80 million in business activity for the state. That's based solely on the economic contributions from Minnesota's immigrant populations. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
The White House refuses to say whether ICE agents will be at polling places in November. the bill to allow the display of the Ten Commandments in schools stalls in Indiana. And union leaders call for the restoration of federal workers' employment protections. With that story and more, it's Simone Perez with the 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're going to have ICE surround the polls come November. We're not going to sit here and allow you to steal the country again. And you can whine and cry and throw your toys out of the pram all you want, but we will never again allow an election to be stolen.
Former Trump advisor Steve Bannon says the administration will send armed federal police to the polls during the upcoming midterms. President Donald Trump recently called for Republicans to, quote, nationalize voting and take running of elections away from targeted locations. He continues to repeat false claims of widespread voting by undocumented migrants, which he blames for his loss to President Joe Biden in 2020. Republican and Democratic state election officials have repeatedly debunked the claim. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says they have no plans to send ICE to election sites, but also refused to rule it out. The administration has finalized rules making it easier to fire thousands of government employees, but labor unions that represent federal workers are calling on Congress to pass a bill that would restore rights to collective bargaining. The Protect America's Workforce Act passed the U.S. House in December, with 20 Republicans voting alongside Democrats. Doreen Greenwald with the National Treasury Employees Union says employment rights for federal workers actually help protect everyone in the country.
It makes sure that there are safeguards in place for the public as well, so that they know that they have people there based on skill and not the old spoils system that was in place prior to having these kind of rights in the workplace.
Republican Georgia Congressman Barry Loudermilk says he won't seek re-election. He's the 29th Republican to announce retirement or to leave their House seat to campaign for higher office. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Bill Clinton have agreed to testify before House oversight in its investigation of sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Clintons are calling for a public hearing rather than a closed-door deposition. Advocates for separation of church and state notched a victory in Indiana this week. Lawmakers there let die a bill to protect public school teachers who display the Ten Commandments in the classroom. Presbyterian minister Timothy McNinch testified against it.
How are Hoosier first graders supposed to understand on their own what to make of commands about adultery or graven images or Sabbath keeping or coveting your neighbor's property, such as their wife?
The legislators could still revive the legislation. Supporters argue the commandments are a historical document, not a religious one. Some Florida voters are suing Republican Governor Ron DeSantis over calling for a special legislative session for mid-decade redistricting. The suit argues DeSantis doesn't have the authority to order new maps. Virginia State Democratic legislators have agreed to a map that would cut to one the number of Republican-leaning districts. The state's 11 seats are nearly evenly divided now. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with an overnight low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow, the rain will return with a daytime high of 52. Today in history, in 1996, the Willamette Valley floods began. In Portland, the river came within inches of flowing over the seawall in Tom McCall Waterfront Park. At least five rivers in Oregon crested at all-time highs during the floods. Downtown Oregon City and Tillamook were submerged for several days during these floods. The quote of the day is from former President Ronald Reagan, born today in 1911. He said, quote, "Politics is supposed to be the second oldest profession. I have come to realize that it bears a very close resemblance to the first."
When Biden was president, he formally apologized for the U.S. government's role in running boarding schools that tried to assimilate Native children by force. Now, one group is working to fulfill the promises from his administration. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Before he left office, President Joe Biden came to Arizona and formally apologized for the federal government's role in running boarding schools designed to forcibly assimilate indigenous children. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, Biden's words still carry meaning as one group continues fulfilling a promise from his administration.
Children would arrive at schools, their clothes taken off, their hair that they were told was sacred was chopped off, their names literally erased, replaced by a number or an English name.
At least 526 facilities were built nationwide and resulted in more than 3,000 deaths.
The pain it has caused will always be a significant mark of shame, a blot on American history.
An enduring pain, Deb Holland, Biden's interior secretary and the daughter of a boarding school survivor, began trying to heal.
For decades, this terrible chapter was hidden from our history books. But now our administration's work will ensure that no one will ever forget.
More than a year later, healing continues within the Gila River Indian community.
It feels like just yesterday that we were doing our opening and we were standing up here and telling you how we were going to make this week be a safe space for you.
That's Lacey Kinner, who is from the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians in Michigan and with the nonprofit National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Their group came to Gila River as part of a national tour collecting boarding school testimonials. They aim to document 400 survivors by the end of the tour. Each video recording will be accessible through the Library of Congress.
One of my favorite things about this work that we do is being able to see healing happening right in front of our eyes.
Charlie Brissett is an oral history program co-director and from the same tribe as Kinner.
We don't say that we're the healers, but we offer space for healing to happen. By the end of the week, too, a lot of our relatives that have shared their story with us come back because they're like family now.
Like boarding school survivor Ramona Klein, who is from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa in North Dakota and sits on the nonprofit's board.
I know what it was like for me, so I'm hoping it was kind of like that for them because there's a relief.
Their intimate project involves a lot of aftercare, with the nonprofit remaining ever mindful of mental health.
Each survivor will be contacted by the person who interviewed them in the next week or so. And then we continue to follow up for the next year. In addition to that, we offer a healing circle that's virtual. We want to be very cognizant that we don't open up wounds and hurt people.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio reporting from the Gila River Indian Reservation.
The National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition will stop in Denver this month to continue its oral history project. This week, Representative Sharice Davids reintroduced the Native American Entrepreneurial Opportunity Act to strengthen the Small Business Administration's Office of Native American Affairs and expand support for Native entrepreneurs. Speaking on the House floor, Davids said Native entrepreneurs face unnecessary barriers to accessing the tools and resources they need to grow, create jobs, and compete. And the bill strengthens programs so they can better meet those needs. To introduce the legislation, Davids was joined by Representatives Eli Crane, Jake Elzey, and Kelly Morrison. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report by the right-wing Heritage Foundation lays out a plan to reshape U.S. family policy by promoting government-funded marriage programs, opposing in vitro fertilization, and advancing heterosexual marriage as the solution to declining birth rates. Critics say it echoes ideas from Project 2025 and could be used as a blueprint to incentivize so-called traditional families while marginalizing others. Judith Ruiz Branch has more.
A recent Heritage Foundation report outlines a vision to reshape U.S. family policy in response to what they call a family crisis gripping the nation. It builds upon ideas promoted in Project 2025, a political initiative that promotes reshaping the federal government in a conservative image. The report's authors advocate for government-funded marriage programs and stress that reviving heterosexual marriage is essential to increasing birth rates and reducing abortion. They blame higher education for delaying marriage and lowering birth rates. Critics like Jessica Waters, senior scholar in residence at the American University of Public Affairs, stress that people need to be paying attention.
The ultra-conservative forces in the country keep giving us blueprints, and we keep thinking they don't mean what they say. Like Project 2025, there was a lot of like, oh, it's just a report from this ultra-conservative group, and it ended up actually being the blueprint for much of what the Trump administration is doing.
Waters adds, much like Project 2025, the proposals outlined in the report work to advance a narrow vision of family life that could very well shape federal and state policy. The report also questions the effectiveness of fertility treatments like IVF and calls for legal protections for fertilized eggs. Joanna Grossman, a professor at Southern Methodist University Dedman School of Law, calls the report selective and simplistic. She believes it fails to consider women's well-being, as well as economic realities and broader social factors influencing decisions about marriage and children.
One of the biggest negative impacts on fertility is poverty, because we don't have access to medical care. And women end up with pelvic inflammatory disease and never get treatment for it or have untreated STDs. But they don't want to talk about poverty because that doesn't feed their story.
The report's resounding message stems from the belief that children thrive in households with married, heterosexual, biological parents and urges a return to what it calls traditional family structures. Waters says the government assuming the role to incentivize the families they want and penalize the families they don't is astounding.
And there are very few people who are going to fall into what this report considers to be a good family. And that is, frankly, a white woman marrying a white man who then has a lot of children and does not work and she stays at home.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. This story was produced with original reporting from Rebecca Sager for the Wisconsin
Intense storms, rain, and waves leave Great Lakes coastal properties exposed, but living shorelines can help protect beaches, homes, and roads. Dr. Anthony Leowitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the Great Lakes region, climate change is causing more intense storms with heavy rain and powerful waves that can erode beaches and bluffs, wash out roads, and damage homes. Properties near the shoreline are most vulnerable, especially when water levels are high. Zoe Kuntz of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative says lake levels rise and fall naturally.
But we're seeing an increased irregularity and extremes with those highs and lows with climate change.
To protect properties, cities and homeowners sometimes build concrete flood walls or other hard barriers. Kuntz says these barriers may provide short-term protection, but they destroy wildlife habitat, and by reducing sandy and marshy areas that absorb waves and water, they often cause more erosion elsewhere. So her group helps communities design and secure funding to create what are called living shorelines. For example, a buffer of deep-rooted marsh grasses that absorb water, break waves, and stabilize the shore.
Really, it's a way to kind of naturalize the shoreline in a way that reflects what it used to be, so it's more resilient to the challenges that we're experiencing along the coastline.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
A school district in Oregon has defeated a Trump administration effort to penalize schools for diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, or DEI. After the year-long legal battle, a local school official hopes to refocus on student success. Isabel Charlet reports.
An Oregon school district has emerged victorious against a Trump administration attempt to punish schools that have curriculum or policies related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. The Justice Department has withdrawn its appeal after a U.S. district court ruled against them in a lawsuit brought by National Teachers Unions and Eugene School District 4J. School board member Jenny Jonak says she's relieved the year-long case is over and hopes that schools can get back to focusing on giving students the tools they need to be successful.
We have always been committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion, not as something to try to give one student an unfair advantage, quite the opposite. We want every student to feel like they are welcome in our schools, they belong, they are part of a larger community.
The case centered on a 2025 Dear Colleague letter from the Education Department, which threatened that federal funding would be withheld from schools that teach students racial history, sociology, or other lessons that reference race. The letter alleges discrimination against white and Asian American students. While Jonak says Eugene 4J's DEI-related programs remain intact, including support for students with disabilities, most schools aren't getting away on harmed. She says the idea that federal funding was threatened, coupled with the ambiguity of the letter, created a chilling effect in many districts.
Some school districts took out any references to diversity or equity or inclusion on their websites or any of their materials. Other school districts probably rethought programs that they may have had.
The letter was followed by a requirement that every state and school district sign a certification that they would adhere to its guidelines. The court's ruling vacated the letter and the certification, calling them both unconstitutional. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Portland's Winter Lights Festival kicks off this evening and runs through Valentine's Day. More than 200 light-based art installations will be visible at over 100 locations across the city, everywhere from Park Rose to Oaks Park. Live events are planned for the main sites downtown, like Pioneer, Courthouse Square, and the World Trade Center Plaza. Organizers write on their website, quote, "The festival is a reason to get out of the house and celebrate winter with the entire community," end quote. But they do advise dressing warmly. This Winter Lights Festival is the 11th one put on by the nonprofit Willamette Light Brigade. They're the same group that pushed for the colored LED lights on the Morrison Bridge and coordinates changing those lights for different events. A map of locations and a list of events is on their website, pdxwlf.com.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 6th, 2026. This is a